Accession number 10180, Reel 2.
John Hatfield, Reel 2. We were talking about your experiences in Spain in a little more detail as related to the changes in government and then the subsequent civil war. And you were giving me the background as you saw it. I wonder if you could continue.
Right. Well, I was saying that in the mid-30s, in fact, not later, the Falangist Party, which was minute, and the Communist Party, which was also very small, gradually came into public view. And this affected the attitude of a lot of people in the middle who were not very extreme, but who tended to resist change, typically middle-class people. The workers became more militant in their thinking during the 30s, but didn't get a lot of help out of the Republican government. So I mentioned earlier that under the Republic there was a period when the right-wing Republicans got into power, and most of them wanted to work within the Republic. There were a few extremists who wanted to change the Republic and go back to a monarchy. And on the right, on the left wing, there were some extremists who wanted to advance towards socialism. A man called Largo Caballero was the leader, and he, his faction within the even within the Socialist Party, was under attack from other factions, just like we have in the Labour Party today. And we'll see later, during the Civil War, he in fact came into power at one point. When the general elections were due in 1936, the left was, meaning moderate and mostly moderate left, but going through to communists, were alarmed at the new militancy of the right wing, which had shown itself in the way the 1934 miners' rising had been put down with the help of the army, including Franco, who was a general in the army. And as a result, the Popular Front was started to try to ensure that the left won the elections, a broad coalition of the left. And that's what happened. They did. They won. And this both astonished and infuriated the extreme right and worried the moderate right, because they imagined the country was going to be taken over by a sort of Stalin-type dictatorship and so on, which of course it wasn't. It just continued for a few months in an attempt to undo the more right-wing measures of the previous government, but basically was a very centre left type government. And that's when the Civil War broke out, as a result of a whole lot of individual incidents where people on one side shot people on the other, people were kidnapped and murdered on both sides. There was a lot of unrest among the workers and the peasants, and there was a general feeling that things were out of hand, that something had to be done. And that led to the rebellion of the army officers, which had been warned of. The government apparently took no notice of the warnings. They thought the army would stay loyal, and that even if they did rise, it would be put down very shortly and everything would be all right. There was an attempt, just after the army rebellion started, by changing the prime minister, to reach some kind of compromise, but it didn't work. And so what happened was that, and all this was coming through in rumours, I remember, and it's been confirmed since, that's what actually happened. There was an attempt by the army to come over from Africa, Morocco, where the Spanish had their only regular army unit called the Legion, which was more like a sort of, it was a professional Spanish army unit, although it was officially a foreign legion. And they also had some Moroccan troops who were a bit like, say, the Indian Army might have been in Britain. They were the only really efficient troops in the country, but they were stuck in Morocco and couldn't get over to Spain. But unfortunately for the other side, the Republican Navy wasn't very efficient, and Franco managed to get some aircraft from Germany, he sent an envoy to see Hitler, who ferried the troops across in small numbers. But then they were able to go right through and gradually take over quite a few cities, gradually attack the Republican areas, and this led to a civil war that lasted 2 years, over 2 years.
And this you would be following this at that level,
yes,
of detail at the time.
That's right, because everybody was fascinated, obviously, and worried and exhilarated according to their point of view. The radio was on everywhere, full blast, all the time, in cafes and everywhere. You could hear, they actually broadcast the proceedings of Parliament over the radio live, and the newspapers were full of propaganda. Of course, immediately the Civil War broke out, the Republic took over all the newspapers in Madrid, so that even a right-wing newspaper would have to come out with pro-left or pro-government articles. And all sorts of new newsletters and broadsheets suddenly sprang up. So everybody was debating what was happening almost minute by minute. But of course, a lot of it was just rumour, so it wasn't very easy to know what you had to believe in, what you should believe in.
So besides the bits you told us just now, which were the truth of what was happening,
as far as I know,
as far as you know, at the time you'd also be discussing and debating a lot of false rumour.
That's right. Well, for instance, there were rumours that various cities had fallen to the rebels, that the army had gone over on a greater scale than it really had, or the other way round, that the rebellion had been crushed when it hadn't, and so on. I mean, one exciting incident to a child was when the main barracks in Madrid, main army barracks in the centre of town, officially rebelled to join the rebellion. In other words, the officers told the men they had to rebel. And don't forget, most of the men were conscripts in those days in the mainland. So what happened was that the population of Madrid, or the workers, the armed workers, surrounded the barracks and attacked it. And this was reported. I used to have, until a few years ago, I wish I had them still, some very good newspapers with photographs of all, in great detail, of what happened. The rebellious military were not able to win, because they were completely surrounded by civilians firing at them with rifles, and by troops who were stayed loyal to the government, and some of the police, for example, even the civil guard. And so they surrendered. And then an incident happened which was reported at the time, and I think it's true. Some of the officers came out with white flags or handkerchiefs, and at the same time, somebody from inside started firing at the besiegers. So the besiegers were furious, thinking that they were being tricked, and fired back and killed a lot of the officers, who were left littered all over the parade ground. But that was how the rebellion was crushed in Madrid. And something similar happened in Barcelona, which was the other big city.
Did you say you saw the newspaper reports. Could you hear the fighting and everything?
I couldn't hear that fighting, but we used to hear shots regularly all over the place, as either people were being murdered or people were just letting off guns. Because don't forget that the people with the rifles were untrained, and a lot of them used to fire at nothing or just fire by accident. But there was a lot of firing going on from time to time. And also, of course, churches got burned on one occasion, which was very traumatic to watch. They went round. They'd done this before under the Republic, but this happened again spontaneously. Groups would go up and burn the church and destroy the images and this kind of thing. And sometimes they shot the priests. The priest I knew, we learned later, had been shot, but I don't know what happened exactly. Because burning churches is a very strong symbolic act which terrifies people who are churchgoers and makes them feel...
You were churchgoers?
Yes, not tremendously so, but we were. We went regularly to church every Sunday.
Did it affect you a lot? Did you think that was a terrible
thing? I thought it was an unpleasant and unnecessary brutal thing to do. But strangely enough, I think my parents were sufficiently politically aware to let me feel somehow that it wasn't very surprising in a way, because the church had been very right-wing at that time, and there's a very long history in Spain of anti-clerical feeling, even though people also accept the church as a normal thing. For instance, there was a woman upstairs, a mother of one of our friends, in the first church burning, who was weeping and crying, this is the end of everything. And I remember thinking, how ridiculous, how exaggerated. So it was nasty, but it was just part of a much bigger thing.
Now, you said you had to get permission before you could leave the country.
Yes.
How did that go about?
Well, I don't know. My parents did all that, so I have no idea. I think it was just that the government felt that they had to have some control. Perhaps they didn't want spies to leave or something. And also, I think they wanted to be sure that lots of foreigners didn't start drifting away and get attacked on the way or fall into some fighting area or something of that sort. So they organised a train with flags of all nations, I remember. We all went on board thinking this was rather ridiculous. Because
what things did you take with you?
Very little. Just a suitcase each.
So you left...
We left everything behind, yes. Yeah.
Well, did you leave it behind... secure, or did you, you know, with arrangements to pick it up or to get it at a later date, or did you just leave it behind?
No, we left it thinking that my father at least would, well, he was staying on at that stage, and that he would stay for a while, and that we would make arrangements.
So you said that you thought these flags of all nations were ridiculous.
Well, the atmosphere seemed a bit absurd, because we were going to leave anyway, you see, so I didn't like to be thought of as a refugee. But it was also exciting because the station in Madrid was patrolled by these armed workers, men and women, as I say, and just as the train was about to leave, a shot was fired, and so the train stopped and everybody wondered what it was and were we under attack. In fact, it wasn't. It was just that somebody had fired by accident. That was a bit typical of the atmosphere.
How many people were there on the... Roughly,
well, I don't know. It was a whole train full, yes, and people of all sorts, most of whom were genuine refugees in the sense that they wanted to get out. I mean, people who thought it was too dangerous to stay, etc., and who wouldn't have left otherwise.
So, where did you go on the train?
Well, it went from Madrid to Valencia.
Was there any incident on the
journey? No. I'd never been to Valencia before, so. That seemed interesting, but the arrangement was that the British people were going to be picked up by the Navy, the British Navy, at Valencia, which is what happened.
So you arrived, and what happened?
Well, we arrived, and the funny thing is I remember nothing about the journey, and all I can remember is that when we arrived, we were taken, I think by bus, to some place in the harbour where we were met by Royal Marines in uniform, who were handing out enormous corned beef sandwiches. And I'd never seen a corned beef sandwich before, and I remember thinking how big the Marines were compared with Spanish soldiers, and how thick and rough their uniform was. You know, the old-fashioned British Army uniform made of very tickly material. So that was interesting. Then we were taken on board HMS Devonshire, which is a cruiser, was a cruiser.
About how many British were there?
Well, I don't remember, but quite a few hundred, I would say. We were accommodated on the main deck, because it was warm, on the upper deck, where hammocks had been hung all along, you know, men and women together, families together, if possible. And, of course, that was good, sleeping in a hammock for the first time. And there were groups of people sitting around all over the deck, and some of the lower decks, too. One or two amusing incidents. My mother had gathered my brother and me to go on this. Her mother, who was Spanish, who didn't want to leave, but she was browbeaten into coming, and my aunt and her son, my cousin. And so there was a little group headed by my mother. And various groups of English women, particularly, who felt worried about all this, irritated my mother by being kind of hand-wringing and slightly hysterical. I remember one incident which I was told of was that one of the women found another woman lying on the floor in her petticoat of the loo that had been allocated to the women, and she rushed up and called one of the seamen and said, "No, please come and do something. There's a woman lying on the floor." And he refused to, because he thought his wife wouldn't like it to see a woman in her underclothes on board a ship. And there was a kind of strange feeling. The sailors were very worried about all these women wandering about on their ship. But they were very kind to us.
Any other incidents on the voyage?
No, we just... small things, like the first time I ever drank lime juice again, because lime juice used to be handed out in the Navy, and they had a canteen where they could buy it. So one of the seamen was being kind to me and asked me would I like a drink, and produced what to me seemed an absolutely gigantic glass of lime juice, a pint glass. I'd never seen anything as long as big as that, and I'd never drunk lime juice before, which I didn't like very much. No, we landed in Marseille after a quiet journey. It was uncomfortable, of course, sleeping in hammocks and trying to find where everything was. We landed at Marseille, and that's when the difficulties began, because my parents then had to my mother had to organise a train for all of us to England, and tickets were hard to get, and she had to find somewhere for us to stay the night and all that kind of thing. However, we eventually got to England.
Were you worried about your father who stayed behind?
I was a bit, but he was always very calm about things like that, and we were quite used to riots and revolutions and things of that sort by that time. I was a bit worried, and I didn't like going off without him, but of course the excitement and the adventure at the moment stopped me worrying about it until later.
So you went by train to...
We went by train across France to Calais, I think, and then across to London, to a suburb of London where my father's sisters lived, in Beckenham.
There. Was that your first visit to England?
No. No, it was my fourth, but the first one was when I was a baby, so it was my third, really. I'd been to England in 1931 and in 1934, very briefly.
So, what was your reception in England, out at Beckenham?
I remember first landing at Dover, yes. As the ferry came in, I remember on the pierhead there were a lot of people sort of cheering and waving, and I think they knew that a group of refugees was coming somehow, or maybe they were just holidaymakers, but I remember my first sight of sort of English people in Dover, and I remember... There was a young girl of about my own age there, for some reason I remember that, wearing shorts, which was something people didn't wear very much in Spain. I thought, England's different. And then when we arrived at my aunt's house, we were looked after with tremendous kindness. I mean, they couldn't have been better, even though they had not just their own nephews, but the other members of the family as well to cope with.
You say you were worried about being treated as refugees. Did you feel you were when you got to England? Were people...
Well, people kept saying, these are my nephews who are refugees from Spain and things like that. And it wasn't a big issue, but I just felt a bit insulted because I felt that that made you seem as though you were kind of uprooted and didn't know what you were doing, whereas in fact we were meant to go to England that year anyway.
How long did you stay at your aunt's?
Several months. I think we arrived in July. I think we stayed there until September. My father actually came over a little later and joined us, and then he went back to Spain.
What about your education? I mean, you must...
Well, yes, well, that was the thing. My parents started to look for schools for my brother and me, back to the original plan. But, of course, the Civil War did cause money problems right away to them. My father didn't know whether he was going to go back or have to stay in head office in London. And if he'd stayed in London, he would have lost a lot of his pay because people were paid more overseas. And meanwhile, his bank had been taken over, which meant that the whole future of his part of it was in doubt. And he didn't know whether he was going to lose his job or not. So there was a great problem about money at that stage, which meant that it was difficult to find a school, which would have to be a private school, because my parents, A, didn't like the idea of me going to an ordinary secondary school, and which in those days there were very few of anyway, and secondly, they were frightened that I couldn't pass entrance exams into English schools because I'd had a very different type of education. So they thought they'd have to find a private school which would accept me and my brother, even though we probably didn't know English history and English maths was taught in a different way and so on.
So what was the solution?
So after going around to various places, including one little public school, I remember, they found a private school in Brighton, which was a day school, basically a day school, run by brothers, Catholic brothers.
Do you know its name?
Yes, it was called the Xaverian College, X-A-V-E-R-A-N, run by an order of St. Francis Xavier, who were originally founded to convert the Red Indians in North America, but instead had turned to running schools in Europe. They've got several in England. They accepted us, and they, I think, were very good about fees. They made special fees in special cases. And so we went there, went to live in Brighton.
What sort of education did you get there, and how did it differ from the French lycée in
Well, Madrid? It was much less intense, much easier, I found. I found it very easy by comparison, except arithmetic. I found the English boys were much better at mental arithmetic, particularly. I mean, they could do things like three times four and threepence and how many half-crowns in a pound, which I found completely incomprehensible. But apart from that, I found it very easy. But what I did like was that the brothers there were very humane, and particularly the headmaster, well, who had been the geography teacher, had a very big influence on me, because he was a forerunner of what nowadays would be called a green. He was very, very much in favour of things like what's now called whole food, wholemeal bread, real ale. He was very much against industrialisation and mass production. He thought craftsmanship was important and that people should enjoy their work. And he was in favour of small-scale ownership of the land, all things like that.
Did that influence you?
Very much, yes, very much. And it tied in with the sort of confused ideas I tried to mention earlier in Spain, where I was sort of, in a way, against the left, because it represented, as many people still think, a kind of massive imposition from above, but very much in favour of social justice and small-scale activity. And I didn't like in the industrial world. One of the things I found when I came to England was that life in England was very dreary, not because of the only because of the climate, but because of the industrial system and the very much greater commercial attitude to things than existed in Spain. For instance, in Spain you could buy your bread in the local bread shop, which you still can. In England you had to go to a grocer's shop where it came out all packaged and looked like cotton wool, and this sort of thing, which was obviously the result of an industrialised, capitalistic type system, which he was very much against.
Now, you'd visited England before, but this was your first concentrated stay.
Well, yes, but I'd seen these things before.
How did you, you were now in an English school, so to speak, yeah. How did that match up with the schoolboy stories and things you heard?
Yeah, well, I was very disappointed on that side, because all these schoolboy stories about people like Tom Merry and so on always had gangs of boys who played football all the time and had rivalries between them. There were lots of prefects and school blazers and all this kind of thing. Now, although we did have school blazers, we only had one prefect who was actually the head of school, who didn't do anything. And I thought this was rather a come-down. It didn't fit in with my idea of a kind of corporate-type, exciting English schoolboy activity. But apart from that, I liked it very much. It sounds awful, doesn't it, now?
How did your father... Did he go back to Spain?
Yes, he went back to Spain. His bank asked him if he'd like to go back and keep the branch open, and so he'd be in charge of it. And he did, thinking that that was the best thing to do, and that he had a great sense of loyalty, and also I think he thought it would do him good in the bank, especially as there was a worry about whether he'd stay on or not. So he stayed there for two more years, right through the siege of Madrid.
Yeah. Did he tell you anything about what was going in letters or...
Yes. Yes, he used to write to us, and we used to send him food parcels. And we knew it was very tough. I mean, the siege of Madrid was very bad. It was bombed and shelled. It was nearly taken several times. and they had very little food. So he stayed with another Englishman in this other person's flat, and our flat he used to visit sometimes, and he found on one occasion that our maidservant had occupied it. She obviously had a key and was living there with her boyfriend. But my father said that he thought this wasn't a bad idea because she kept an eye on the furniture. So that's the sort of thing that happened.
During this period of the Spanish Civil War, how did you react to things like the international brigades that were coming, the British battalion as well?
Well, I think by that time I'd begun to... Well, I was called sort of schizophrenic about the whole thing. In a way, I thought Franco still, his side, wasn't just Franco, should win. But at the same time, I admired the international brigade and people of that sort because they were idealistic. At the beginning, I thought they were wrong, but gradually I began to think that perhaps they were right. Because a lot of stories came through about how when Franco's lot would take a town, they used to execute thousands of people. At the beginning, I didn't believe this. I thought it was propaganda. But in fact, gradually one realized that it was true. And although I still thought that the International Brigade was something really to help the Communist Party, or was being fueled by a sort of wrong-headed, liberal, muddled thinking, you couldn't help admiring the people who did it. And of course, although my father still wanted Franco to take over Madrid, because I think he felt that was the only way to stop the fighting, he and therefore I also admired the way that the ordinary people were defending it.
What did you think of the other fascist regimes that were involved in?
We mean the Germans and the Italians? Well, the Italians, everyone despised completely, perhaps unfairly, but they were regarded as a sort of lot of stupid people who didn't know what they were doing. And as you know, they were defeated very heavily in a battle by the Republican troops, by the International Brigade, I think. The Germans, of course, again, everybody hated. Everybody, meaning my family and the people we knew. It was felt to be a tremendous mistake, a tremendous wrong action on the part of Franco's people to rely so much on the Germans. But on the other hand, the Russians were helping the Republic, so that made it both equally bad, you see, from that point of view.
You didn't like the Russians either, then?
No, because Stalin was regarded as the bogeyman already, and communism was regarded as a danger to Western civilization, etc.